A reading from the book of Jeremiah. My joy is gone, grief is upon me, my heart is sick. Hark, the cry of my poor people from far and wide in the land. Is Yahweh not in Zion? Is her king not in her? Why have they provoked me to anger with their images, with their foreign idols? The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. For the hurt of my poor people, I am hurt. I mourn, and dismay has taken hold of me. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then has the health of my poor people not been restored? Oh, that my head were a spring of water, and my eyes a fountain of tears, so that I might weep day and night for the slain of my poor people. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Luke. Then Jesus said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was squandering his property. So he summoned him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give me an accounting of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer.' Then the manager said to himself, 'What will I do now that my master is taking the position away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do so that when I am dismissed as manager, people may welcome me into their homes.' So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He answered, 100 jugs of olive oil.' He said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 50. Then he asked another, 'And how much do you owe?' He replied, 100 containers of wheat. He said to him, 'Take your bill and make it 80. And his master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the children of this age are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than are the children of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes. Whoever is faithful in a very little is faithful also in much. And whoever is dishonest in a very little is dishonest also in much. If then you have not been faithful with the dishonest wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful with what belongs to another, who will give you what is your own? No slave can serve two masters. For a slave will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth." The Gospel of Christ.
When we began the season of creation a couple of weeks ago, I had mentioned that though the season has been put into the calendar, the readings of the Revised Common Lectionary have not been altered to reflect that theme. And this is a prime example of that. To try to get something about the creation out of these readings would be extremely difficult, so I'm not going to try to make that happen. However, I think it actually is rather timely to get the readings that we do see here, in particular the first reading from Jeremiah chapter 8, and the accompanying sense that Psalm 79 brought with it as well. The situation in Jeremiah is something that was not expected of people. And we read it, as I said, in the 8th chapter. One thing about the book of Jeremiah, by the way, if you ever set out to read it, it's not put together in chronological order. It's arranged instead more of a thematic order. So here we are in chapter 8, talking about something that really happens at the end of all of Jeremiah's life and the history of Jerusalem of the time. And here it is at the beginning of the book. But anyway, in chapter 8, what's happening is Jerusalem is being besieged. People are starving to death. People are dying in battle. And the concern that Jeremiah is bringing up is that this very thing is happening. And he's speaking even on behalf of the people. He says, "My joy is gone. Grief is upon me. My heart is sick. Hark, the cry of my poor people from far and wide in the land. Is Yahweh not in Zion? Is her king not in her?" And the point with those questions is that if God is present with us, why on earth is this happening? Why are we enduring this kind of difficulty? Because the understanding had always been that with Yahweh being present with the people of Israel, then things would go well. It was a promise. It was something that was emphasized. It was something that was visually represented, according to the story of the history of Israel, for ages past already. In Exodus chapter 13, when the people of Israel are leaving slavery in Egypt and they're making their way towards the promised land, it says that there was a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night that always went before them. This pillar of cloud and fire representing the presence of God. In Exodus 33, Moses would go into the tent of meeting and that cloud would descend on the tent of meeting and Yahweh would speak with Moses there. And Moses is getting his divine direction from the very presence of God. As time progresses, we see with the dedication of the temple that Solomon built later on, the cloud of the glory of God fills the temple so that the priests are unable to perform their duties. And this wonderful image of God being there is part of the package. But then we get this idea that if God's there, why is this happening? And the people of Israel have to try to make sense of this. It's like, if these things are going on, well, there's got to be a reason. And they come to conclude that it was because they were being disobedient. And then that changed God's mind or something. The prophet Ezekiel, which comes after Jeremiah, tells visionary stories that he had had. And in one vision, in chapter 11 of his book, he describes how the cloud of God's glory ascended from Jerusalem and its temple and went to the east. God was leaving the building. This is similar to what had happened back in the days of King Saul when the Ark of the Covenant, which had represented the presence of God, was lost to the Philistines and taken out of Israel. The priest Eli had a son, and his wife named the son Ichabod, which means the glory has departed. Speaking about the tragedy of this idea that God was no longer present with God's people. It was restored under King David, which was cool. But here with Ezekiel, after this, the cloud of the glory of God has left. And when the time came for Israel to be restored, Ezekiel's vision is the cloud comes back and once again takes its place in Jerusalem, indicating the blessed presence of God once again in the people of Israel. One of the things we asked in the first sermon a couple of weeks ago was, where is God? And we talked about the idea of a transcendent God who is over and above all things, and an immanent God who was very, very present in all things. The idea of the transcendent God, we said, carries some problems, and especially in situations like this. If bad things are happening to us, and God is over all things, God must be up to something, because God is transcendent and over all things. So what is it that God is up to, and why would this be happening to us? And that becomes an explanation, I would suggest a rather fearful explanation, about what's happening. But holding on to the idea of the immanent God, of the very present God, also creates its challenges, depending on what we are assuming that very presence of God is supposed to do. For the ancient Israelites, that very real, close presence of God was supposed to result in their blessing. So the only explanation they could have when blessing wasn't happening is that God had left. But here's the problem. If God is immanent, God being immanent means there is nowhere that God is not. God can't leave anywhere if God is always everywhere. So what does the presence of God mean in the midst of challenging times like the times of Jeremiah? This is probably a good question to explore these days, because we're facing some interesting and challenging times. We've got an unpredictable leader to the south, who over the past 6 months or whatever has been doing a fine job of dismantling this democracy, and we have no idea what's coming next. What is our economy going to do in relation to the tariffs that are being imposed? And who knows what else is going to happen with the rise of political violence down there, with both people on the left and the right being killed? This is never a good thing. We are this close to a shooting war in Europe, with Russia invading Polish airspace with drones and then Estonian airspace with fighter jets. Article 4 of the NATO agreement has been invoked, which is when all the NATO nations get together to discuss whether this was actually an act of aggression. And if it's determined that it is an act of aggression, then it invokes Article 5, which is an attack on one NATO nation is an attack on all, and NATO declares war on Russia. Right now in my work as a military chaplain, I can tell you, we are preparing for war in the Canadian Armed Forces right now. We are not simply operating as a peacetime army. We are expecting to be in a shooting war in Europe. Who knows exactly how soon, but it's getting shorter, is the expectation. If that should happen, then what? What will war with Russia look like? What impact will that have on our economy? What impact will that have on our lives? The expectation is that the first day of a shooting war in Europe will probably result in 30,000 casualties on the NATO side, 10% of those being fatalities, and 10% of those being the Canadian portion. So 300 members in the first day. And so one of my questions is, how many next of kin notifications will I have to do to families who have lost loved ones in that battle? Things are going to change pretty dramatically. Things are not exactly looking comfortable. We might wonder, what on earth is God up to? Especially if God is transcendent and moving nations like chess pieces, what are you doing? Do we have an easy explanation for that? The Israelites thought they did. Well, if this is happening to us, it must be because we've been sinning. Is that a satisfactory answer for what's happening in the world today? Well, maybe, if we just say that everybody's sinning and God's just had it up to here or something, but I don't think anybody's really reaching for that explanation. But if we are holding on to the reality of God's imminent presence, that God is here regardless, God is present in the midst of all of this, what does that mean for us? Because how we answer this question, I'm going to suggest to you, is going to affect how we navigate whatever it is that's coming up around the corner. And those of you who've been around the block with me know that I'm not a fear-mongering kind of person. I'm not here trying to say, woe to us all. I'm just saying, who knows what's going to happen? And we might be concerned and worried and wonder, you know, is Alberta going to separate from Canada? Like, there's any number of things we could be worried about. But how we navigate these things is going to depend on how we answer that question of what it means that God is present. If we look back in history, we can see significant events in the world, big events, that create for us, well, a similar kind of dilemma as we talk about where is God in it all. So if we go back just over 100 years, the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, we have La Belle Époque in France, we have the innocence of the Edwardian era in England. Canada had been established as a nation in 1867 and was expanding its territory. It seemed like everything was good. Well, unless you were First Nations in Canada, then things weren't so good during that time because Canada was expanding its borders in the late 19th century. Where is God in that point? Well, if you're living through the Belle Époque or you're in the Edwardian era, or you're part of this newly fledged country in Canada, you're probably feeling, hey, God is with us. Life is pretty cool. It's lovely. Obviously, we're being blessed by God. Look at how lovely things are. If you're First Nations, you might think differently because of what ended up happening and the fact that you were losing your home and being pushed off your land. If God is imminent, if there's nowhere that God is not, where is God for the First Nations at that time? Where is God for the English and the French? Then the Great War happens and shatters the innocence of the Edwardian era and ends La Belle Époque in a rather significant way when Paris is now occupied, or when France is being attacked, rather. We now suddenly have what was called the war to end all wars, because now these French and English people who had been enjoying such a lovely time are now being slaughtered in muddy trenches in the French countryside. Germany's aggression coming against the French and English, and they're trying to defend, and it was a horrible thing, and Canada's contributing troops, and it affects our economy and everything, and peoples whose homes are destroyed are having to figure out what they're going to do instead. Where is God now? All of a sudden, where is God now? Did God go somewhere? If God is immanent, God didn't go anywhere. One could say God can't go anywhere if God is immanent. And what do you do with the fact that there are Christians on the German side in World War I and Christians on the French and English side in World War I, killing each other because of this conflict? Where is God in that? What are we supposed to make of this? What is God trying to do? If we think of the transcendent God who's in charge of things and moving people around, it's like, what are you doing? But even with the immanent God, where is God in the middle of this? Well, then World War II comes to an end. And in North America, we go through a decade known as the Roaring Twenties. There is prosperity, there's success, we won, life is good, we're having a great time. But if you're in Germany, you're now subject to punitive sanctions that required bags of Deutschmarks to be brought into a store to buy a loaf of bread. If you're a Christian in North America in the 1920s, you're thinking, where is God? Obviously, he's right here with us. Look at all the blessing we have. And we beat the bad guys in World War and in the Great War. If you're a Christian in Germany and you're asking the question, where is God in this? As you bring in your bags of money to buy a loaf of bread, you might have a more difficult time trying to answer that question. But then everything flips. Because in the 30s, the Dust Bowl happens, the Great Depression begins in North America, and now the prosperity of the 20s is quickly forgotten, except for the wealthiest, of course, but the prosperity of the 20s is replaced by the Dust Bowl of the 30s, the Dirty 30s, the Great Depression, people losing jobs and families are being torn apart because they're trying to figure out how they can make a living and all these things, and suddenly things are really quite horrible in North America. And the Christian in North America asks, where is God in this? What happened? How did we go from the Roaring Twenties to the Dirty Thirties just like that? Over in Germany, things started to change because there was this guy that showed up that promised to support and protect the Christian religion. He began to turn around the economy in Germany, gave everybody a car, the Volkswagen, designed by Ferdinand Porsche, something we don't like to talk about. But the idea is that things started to turn around in Germany. And now in the 30s, if you're a Christian in North America, you're kind of wondering where God went. If you're a Christian in Germany, you're beginning to think that God has heard the cries of the people. And suddenly we move on our way to World War II. And once again, because of Hitler's advancement, we see the world brought into war once again. And now what do you do? Where is God in this? Especially if you're someone living in Coventry or London or Berlin or these other places that have been bombed like crazy. You're just living your life, doing your thing, and bombs rain down and destroy your home, destroy your business. You become a refugee who's having to move from where you had lived to try to find what property you still have left and try to go somewhere else. All the while, all the infrastructure is being destroyed. It's like, what did I do? How is God present in this? What am I supposed to do with this? And we could, of course, go on and carry on through the 20th century into the 21st century and see different things that have a major effect on the world. And when we ask ourselves the question, where is God in this? It's very much going to be affected by what we are expecting God is supposed to do by being present in this. And if the idea is God is supposed to bring about justice and righteousness and correct all the wrong, that never happens. It didn't even happen for Jeremiah. Jeremiah was innocent in his day. He did nothing wrong as far as it goes. He responded to the call to become a prophet. He arguably gave up the opportunity to be married to instead follow this call to be a voice speaking truth to power, to be able to tell people, got to be warned about making sure you're obeying God and all of this. And then all the bad things that happened to him. He was in Jerusalem starving when it was besieged. He didn't get killed in battle. He didn't get carried off to exile in Babylon, but he was carried off into exile in Alexandria in Egypt and ended his days not living in the city that he loved, in the land that he loved. Jeremiah died never seeing the fulfillment of any of the things he talked about. Jeremiah suffered just like everybody else, yet it could be argued was not guilty of what everybody else had been doing. Where was justice for Jeremiah, if that's what's just supposed to happen? It is really easy for us to view what we think is supposed to happen with the presence of God. It's very easy for us to view things too simplistically. Well, this is happening because of that. Well, it's got to be because of this that we now encountered that. And God's in charge, and so we're just going to trust that. But very quickly, that whole idea, God's in charge, we're just going to trust it, often creates more challenge. Because for all the promises we read about that we never see being fulfilled, we're left with those couple of things we usually say, well, God's ways are not our ways. God's ways are higher. We just got to trust. And yet it never seems to unfold the way it's supposed to. In reality, how is it supposed to unfold? Right now, with Russia attacking Ukraine, the Russian Orthodox Church is supporting the Russian forces, and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church are supporting the Ukrainian forces. What is God doing, pitting Christian against Christian? Is there some wisdom in that? Is God deciding that national boundaries trump the actual connection we have as fellow Christians? That doesn't seem to make sense to me. The situations are far more complex than the way that we usually simply want to just say, well, God will work it all out. So what do we do instead? How do we find peace in whatever troubled times might be around the corner? What is it that we can do? How can we hold on to this notion of the imminent presence of God, no matter what it is that we encounter? Well, this is where I would suggest to you the traditional blessing that we tend to give at the end of a service comes into play. The blessing today is a little bit different, but typically I will say, and now may the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, keep your hearts and minds in the love of God and the knowledge of Jesus Christ our Lord, right? The peace of God that transcends understanding, the peace of God that doesn't make sense, the peace of God that it, you know, shouldn't be there, it would seem, given whatever we're facing, but we have it anyway. Because in every one of the situations I articulated, whether we're talking about the successes of the Roaring Twenties or the harm of the Dirty Thirties, Christians who are paying attention to God and being devoted to God are on the one hand, in times of good, happy to thank God and be grateful for what they have. And then when times are tough, are still saying, Lord, you are going through this with me. You are suffering with me. You haven't gone anywhere, you're right alongside. The image of Jesus as the suffering servant, the one who came to reveal the God that is over all things in human form, the one who lived a human life and experienced all the ups and downs of it, including being put to death, is right there sticking closer than a brother, never to leave us, never to forsake us, but to walk with us through each and every challenge. And over and over and over again, we often hear stories of people who have gone through tremendous difficulty. And they'll say, nevertheless, I know that God is with me. I know that Christ is here. And whatever happens, I know God hasn't abandoned me. There's no way to fully understand how things turn out when big, difficult things emerge. But we must be careful to understand that God isn't going anywhere. And what God is to do in that presence, or what we can expect God to do, is to be there with us, sustaining us, and helping us through whatever the challenge is that we face. It's not up to us to try to figure out, okay, how is this supposed to work? Is God trying to do something here? Is God trying to teach me a lesson? Have I sinned or something? Like, oh my goodness, maybe if I repented enough, things could change. Or maybe if I could convince enough people in our nation to repent, maybe things would change. It's not that simple. It's not that easy. But knowing that as we go through the challenging times, that God is present regardless, that gives us hope, that gives us peace, that gives us confidence to keep moving forward and to endure whatever it is we might have to endure. Because in all of these episodes that we've articulated, there are people who came to the end of their lives not seeing the end of the suffering, not seeing the end of the difficulty, and yet have still been in the presence of God despite it all. So this may not come across, perhaps, as the most encouraging and fun and light sermon, but the reality is, Jesus said, in this world you will have trouble. He did go on to say, but take heart, I have overcome the world. What exactly that looks like, I'm not entirely certain, but one thing I do know is he said, in this world you will have trouble. We shouldn't be surprised. We are not exempt from the suffering that humanity brings upon itself. We're not somehow excluded from the suffering that happens from time to time with natural disasters. But how we face that suffering is what makes all the difference in the world. And when we embrace that imminent presence of God to give us the peace that passes all understanding, we are able to carry on through that suffering, come what may, and remain faithful and confident in the God revealed to us in Jesus Christ. Amen.